This is Professor Carlson, and this is part two of the lecture for October 23rd. When we left off, we were about to begin a discussion of the Master Plastics Corporation case. This is slide 13, and it addresses some new and additional limitations on the employee's right to engage in protected activity. These are mainly contractual and statutory limits on the right to strike. Now, in Master Plastics Corporation, the employees were striking because they complained about an alleged unfair labor practice by the employer. When the strike was over, they asked to return to their jobs, but the employer denied them their jobs and discharged them for having engaged in the strike. So let's see what happens here. There are really two separate issues here. One is the employer's argument that the strike violated the no-strike clause of the collective bargaining agreement. And as I've warned before, employees don't have a right to violate their own promise not to engage in a strike. And the no-strike clause is the basic quid pro quo for the employer to sign a collective bargaining agreement. It's his motivation for engaging in collective bargaining. It's the 3 years of labor peace. But the applicability of the no-strike clause to any particular interruption of the work depends on the words of the no-strike clause. It could be broad or it could be narrow. The broad clause that most employers will seek prohibits any strike or any interruption of the work by the employees. You can imagine something much narrower that might apply only, for example, to disputes over a breach of the collective bargaining agreement. The difficulty with that narrow form, of course, is that employees sometimes go out on strike for other reasons. They may go out on strike for a political cause, for example, and it won't be covered by the collective bargaining agreement. This clause applies to any interruption of the work, and the employer therefore argues it doesn't matter that this strike was to object to an alleged unfair labor practice. The strike was unprotected. It was in breach of the collective bargaining agreement. But the court holds that presumptively, even a broad form clause does not bar an unfair labor practice strike. And that means that these strikers are still protected, at least if the unfair labor practice was a serious one. And it's that bracketed language that's added by later cases, which is to avoid the possibility that employees can walk out any time there is some relatively minor violation of the law by the employer. It has to be a serious one that threatens the integrity of the collective bargaining process or that seeks to destroy the union. Now, this all depends on the language of the agreement. Beware of the fact that the union might in fact agree not to go out on strike even as an objection to an unfair labor practice, but that will be a matter of negotiation. Let's advance to slide number 15 now, which is the Section 8B issue. The employer alleges that the strike was also illegal because it was without the required advance notification required by Section 8D. Now, Section 8D is one of two or three different notice provisions that unions have to give before they go out on strike. The purpose of all of these notice provisions in the law has to do with giving the government an opportunity to prepare for the disruption caused by some very big strikes, and secondly, perhaps to provide for mediation if the government thinks that it should try to assist the parties. But aside from its purposes, if the union strikes prematurely without having given the requisite advance notice, this again is an unprotected strike, and the employer can ordinarily fire the employees who participate. But the court adds an important qualification here. It holds that the notice provisions, at least the general notice provision of the NLRA, does not apply to unfair labor practice strikers, people who are objecting a serious violation of the law by the employer. So that the strikers remained protected in this case, and that means that the employer violated the NLRA by discharging them. Let's move on now to slide number 16, the employer's response to a union's strike. And of course, one of the basic responses is on the hiring of replacements. Let's go to slide 17 and talk about the factors that affect the employer's ability to prevail in a strike, or the union's ability to prevail for that matter, factors affecting the outcome of the strike. Well, number one, what's the labor market like? Are there a lot of same skilled workers that are available to replace the strikers and who are willing to cross the picket line? Number two, the employer's ability to continue operations by any of at least three different means. For example, transferring employees from other departments or areas to fill the slots formerly performed by the striking employees. B, contracting out. We could hire independent firms to perform the work formerly done by these employees. And C, we can hire replacements, which is our big topic here. Can the employer hire new people to take the jobs formerly done by the strikers? Now, there are some other ways the employer can work through this strike. He can have stockpiled his production or reserved cash to survive the duration of the strike. An important factor will be the bargaining unit's solidarity in observing the strike. A successful strike requires something pretty close to unanimous support of the employees, because if some of them are crossing the picket line as the strike goes on, that trickle will turn into a flood. If it's a long strike, eventually that flood will happen. Number five, the ability of the employees to survive without paychecks. In some industries, employees know that strikes are coming, and so they save money in advance. And number six, public support and possible public or consumer boycott of the employer in support of the strike. So let's advance now to slide number 18, which is arguably about the single most important case in American labor law. It's the NLRB versus Mackey Radio and Telegraph case. Now, in the Mackey Radio and Telegraph case, the employees have gone out on strike, and the employer has decided to continue its operations during the strike. Let's move on to slide number 19. The employer has continued operations by transferring workers from other sites to fill the struck jobs. And employees are being transferred from other cities, in this case, all around the country to come to the facility in San Francisco. But to get people to make this move, the employer offers them that these jobs in San Francisco will be permanent. It is perhaps the only way to get people to leave their homes and accept work for an indefinite period of time in a place very far from where they live right now. You promise them permanency, and then they can move their homes and accept that this is where they will live for the future. Well, when the strike ends, all but 11 of the strikers have been replaced. Eventually, the employer reinstates all but about 5 of the strikers, because not all of the transferees have decided to stay. But having transferred people to San Francisco, we now have more employees and we have jobs, and 5 of the strikers now have no jobs to return to, at least not for now. And the union alleges a violation in the form of a Section 8A1 charge, interference with employee rights, and 8A3, discrimination. Let's advance to slide number 20, which is the discovery that replacement may be permanent. The right to strike, as the court observes, does not diminish the employer's right to survive the strike by maintaining its operations, and it can do this by offering permanent jobs to replacements. And when the strike is over, because these replacements are permanent, these replacements need not be laid off to make room for strikers. Eventually, as job openings occur, the employer must offer new openings to the replaced strikers. And let me point out a typographical error there in the last bullet, because the word replacements should be strikers. The replaced strikers must be recalled as openings occur But the order of recall must not be discriminatory. And in this case, the employer violated the law, not because it hired permanent replacements, but because it granted the first openings to strikers who were not particularly supportive of the strike, and the last to be recalled, and those eventually not recalled at all, happened to be the primary movers and leaders of the strike. That was unlawful discrimination by the employer. Let's go on to slide 21. Is replacement really permanent? Well, yes, it is, to the extent that the strikers don't get their jobs back unless and until there is an opening with the employer, and the employer doesn't have to lay off the replacements to get the strikers back into the workplace. Now, this rule only applies to an economic strike, in other words, a strike in support of employee bargaining demands, and the employer must, in fact, have offered permanency to the replacements at the time that it made these job offers to them. There's a lot of conflict, or at least a lot of discussion, about whether hiring permanent replacements must actually have been necessary for the employer. You can imagine that sometimes employers are eager to hire permanent replacements if they can undermine the union by doing so. Do they have to be in a position where they have to in order to maintain operations? And the law is not altogether clear even at this date. I'll give you my own interpretation of the law based on what the NLRB has said, and that is that the employer must have believed that an offer of permanence was necessary, and we don't really require the employer to prove that it was right. The employer tends to get away with a lot at this point, simply getting up on the witness stand and slurring under oath, I thought that it would be necessary to offer these replacements, permanent jobs, to get them to cross the picket line. Still, we can imagine circumstances in which it's clear that the employer did this only to destroy the union. There are the cases of so-called secret replacement, where the employer, planning all along to destroy the union, provokes a strike, and then lures the strikers into the false security of thinking that there will be no permanent replacement, but then in fact the employer secretly hires permanent replacements so that it doesn't have to bring the strikers back. If you can prove that kind of plan by the employer, this would clearly be a violation of the law. Finally, it's important for employers and employees to understand the difference between permanent replacement on the one hand versus discharge or termination. This is a hard distinction for a lot of employees, and sometimes for law students even, to grasp. Discharge or termination terminates your relationship with the employer, not even on a recall list, whereas permanent replacement is a little bit like being on layoff status. You are on the preferential hiring list, and if a job opening occurs, you have the right to that job, provided you're next in line on the recall list. Now, that means that the employer has to be careful about its choice of words, because if it discharges an employee instead of telling him he's permanently replaced, we could have a violation, perhaps even where none was really intended. Let's move on to slide number 22. What about the order of reinstatement? Well, as I've said, the replaced strikers remain employees as if on layoff, and they remain on a preferential hiring list until they find other equivalent employment. And the employer has to be careful about his words in telling the employees about their status. You will have instances in which employers will tell returning strikers they have been terminated, perhaps because the employer didn't really understand the nuances of the law. The rule is this: if you tell employees or strikers, if you announce to them, perhaps while they're on the picket line, you've all been terminated because I've replaced you, the employer has just violated the law. Moreover, if you tell them that they are or will be terminated before you've actually hired replacements, you're going to have to bring those strikers back when they are ready to come back to work, because you committed the unfair labor practice before you actually replaced the workers. Let's go on to slide number 23 now, terms of employment of non-strikers and replacement. It turns out that sometimes workers need an economic incentive to cross the picket line that might be in the form of a higher rate of pay during the strike, maybe even a pre-work bonus to cross the picket line. Higher pay during the strike to induce replacements to cross the picket line is a lawful employer action. Moreover, the employer has no duty to bargain over the payment of this extra compensation because the union, it said, has a conflict of interest. Its duty is to represent employees equally even when they cross the picket line, but the union obviously can't be expected to fairly represent strike breakers over the question of their entitlement to a strike bonus. You can pay employees a little bit more to get them to cross the picket line during the strike, but after the strike, no discrimination in pay or benefits will be allowed. Let's go on to slide number 24, which is TWA versus Independent Federation of Flight Attendants. And it takes us to the problem of fighting over seniority rights at the conclusion of a strike. Now, in the TWA case, you have employees who are returning from strike. These are flight attendants. And when the flight attendants return from their strikes, they discover that there are still some openings left for some of the strikers, but they're not where the flight attendants used to work. Their favorite job slots in places like New York and San Francisco and Hawaii, they've been filled by non-strikers and by replacements. And the returning strikers say, well, look, you have enough jobs so that you could give me work. I think I should get my old post in San Francisco back and take that young strike breaker and return them to Des Moines, where they were working before the strike. This brings us to the question of post-strike seniority rights. And let's go now to slide number 26. It's a difficult problem in a number of ways. What are the seniority rights, respective seniority rights, of strikers and non-strikers? And it's a complicated problem for a lot of reasons, because after the strike, the employer's business may be reduced as a consequence of the strike. What happens if we have layoffs? The usual rule is that layoffs will be in order of seniority in a collective bargaining environment, but the replacements would tell you that this is a difficult rule for them, because even though they were offered permanent employment, they'll be the first to be laid off in the event of a reduction in force. The U.S. Supreme Court held in Erie Resister that this is the inevitable result of the seniority system. Moreover, an employer is prohibited from granting super seniority to strike replacements in an effort to get them to cross the picket line. In Erie Resister, in essence, the employer granted replacements an extra 10 years of seniority, credited them with 10 years, to cross the picket line so that they would not be laid off in the event of a future reduction in force. And the court held that this was unlawful discrimination. On the other hand, in TWA, the court holds that the end of the strike is not to be regarded as an event for bumping junior employees from their posts. And that means that the returning strikers are going to get jobs back if there are enough to go around, but they don't necessarily get the posts from which they departed. The younger non-strikers who fill those slots during the strike are allowed to stay exactly where they are. We don't regard this as a reduction in force situation, The older strikers are going to have to start wherever they are coming back from the strike, and they only get their jobs at the favored posts as jobs in those positions become available. Let's move on now to the topic of unfair labor practice strikes, which, as I've said before, are strikes because of some unfair labor practice by the employer. I'm going to call this or mark this as the end of part two, however, and go ahead and try to upload this. And we will begin part three in a little while, beginning with the topic of unfair labor practice strikes.